Hello.
What's up, brother?
Let's talk about fits and starts.
Fits and starts is about people our age talking about work.
Fits and starts is highly specific, but highly specific in the things I'm interested in.
The things that I like.
I think that I didn't fall asleep.
Conversations that you guys have are like real life conversations. If you were like sitting in my living room, so keep up that good work.
Like podcasting, honey.
But ding! There's really only one thing I don't like.
Mic problems.
Not often you get to hear two white dudes give their opinions on stuff. Annoying bros, but not annoying.
Like, no, you know what fits and starts is like?
Fits and starts.
Fits and starts is a morale booster. That's absolutely what it is.
This week, we talk about the difference between the theoretical idea of a job and what a job actually requires of you and how you fit into that. And then we do some navel-gazing after that, explaining our process of making the show. As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, hit us up on Twitter. Our handles are in the show notes. College is probably the worst time for actually understanding what you're good at and understanding where you might fit into a job. And it's funny to look back even just 3 years ago and realize how little I knew. Obviously, there's still a ton of things I don't know, but you're so bad at sizing things up because you don't understand what a job actually requires. So I'm interested in this topic because now I feel like I have a better understanding of that. And it's especially important for me because I'm out there looking for new jobs, right? Some of the times that I have been really like backwards on this or have been confused about this is where I'm thinking about like the theoretical underpinnings of a job rather than what a job actually looks and smells like. And I had a few examples of this, and I don't know, you may have some of your own examples, but like, so when I was studying economics, I was really interested in like what we talked about in terms of banking and like investment analysis and things like that. I was really interested in like the theory of learning how banks worked and these ideas of like the reserve ratio and things like that and like the creation of money and the velocity of money. And like I found all that stuff really interesting from this theoretical standpoint. It is still really interesting. It's very theoretical and it's like very mathematical and it's stuff that I could like listen to podcasts about it for hours. So
by the way, on a quick side note, do you remember that one time when you suggested that you and I should start a bank?
I do, because I thought I was super interested in it. And so I thought like, because of the theoretical ideas of how banks worked, I was like, wow, this is so interesting. And then, you know, I took that information in college as like a very ignorant, effectively child. You're effectively a child when you're in college. I took that and thought, huh, I think that means that I would like to work in banking. Like I spent like a year just assuming like, yeah, I could end up in banking. That would be something that I would like.
Mm-hmm.
And that year was it's a really stupid way to spend a year, is just like sitting there dwelling on this like unformed idea that you have rather than going out and talking to people. And what really, really changed my opinion was like, I just went and started talking to people who had jobs in banking, and it took, you know, almost no time at all to realize like, that is absolutely not a job that I want to do, because
right.
it's nobody's job to like dwell on the complex theory of banking, right?
Right.
Banking is like kind of a sales position. And if it's not a sales position, it's just a straight up accounting position. Like there's no like creativity in banking. There's very little like theory in banking. Like the theory is set in stone and everyone's job is just to like carry out the functions of what a bank does, which are pretty straightforward. I was talking to...
Gone are the days of the mercenary banker.
Yeah, right. Time was. You just got to make it up as you go.
Time was. A man could start an oil company and leverage that into a bank.
Yeah. And so that was like a, kind of one of the first examples of me realizing like the differences between like the theoretical idea of a job and what a job actually entails, and talking to people and realizing like these guys were just like, I was like, so banking's super interesting, right? And they're like, the guys I was talking to were like, no, it's like a sales position. Like people want loans and we compete for those loans. And that's pretty much it. And we want to attract consumers to come put money in the bank. So we run like pretty straightforward marketing campaigns to get people to use our bank. Because, like, oh, well, that's not interesting at all.
Right. What you were thinking is running the Federal Reserve is pretty interesting, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, how do I be Bernanke's intern?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, another example of this is, like, when I became interested in politics, again, I was interested in political theory and, like, the ideas, like moral arguments about how things ought to be, and saying, like, telling Dr. Green, one of my history professors at the time, like, yeah, I think I'm kind of interested in politics. And he kind of smirked and was like, you know, you're not really a Washington guy. Like, he's like, I know Washington people and you're not one of them. I was like, oh, okay. I didn't realize that that was a thing. Cause, like, again, nobody's job in Washington is to, like, wonder about, like, the moral arguments about the way things ought to be. They're all, like, practitioners and, like, they're doing, like, horse trading on, right, like, on, like, favors and money and endorsements, and that's a completely different game that has nothing to do with the kind of things that I'm interested in. Sorry, I'm rattling off all these examples. Maybe this is an interesting, and we can cut all this out. But
no. Give me more examples.
Another example was when I was 13 years old, we had a professional shadowing day. And I was really interested in entrepreneurship, which I'm still interested in. And I went to the coffee shop that was down the street from my parents' house and spent the day following around the proprietor of this coffee shop, because it was a really great coffee shop called Kayak Coffee in St. Louis. And I thought, I'd like to do what this guy's doing. And I just followed him around, and he was really nice and taught me how to make espresso and whatever else. But he was like, he kind of laughed at one point. He was like, you want to know what it is to be an entrepreneur? It just means you don't sleep. Like, he's like, I just take less money and don't sleep. And I was like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, I was like, that's kind of it. And then one of the other ones, which was like, this was actually like something that I was planning to go do and then was derailed by one conversation, was at the end of college. I don't know if you weren't around for this, but, I don't know if you remember, I got really into the idea of starting up Chattanooga's first independent movie theater.
I was not around for this.
Mitch Prentice and I got like neck deep in this idea. And we, again, were focused way too much on the theory. And we were building spreadsheets and writing up lots of documents about like the way we thought things ought to be. And spent hours and hours, weeks, months trying to understand this thing. And then we finally, we wrote this whole like market approach and pro forma financials and all this different stuff, because we were really convinced that we were going to start the first ever independent movie theater in Chattanooga and that it was going to be a smash hit. The thing that we realized was that we needed to go talk to people who were actually doing this. Which is like the best advice that you could give any college student is just like, what's the thing you think you want to do? Go like interview people who actually do that thing and right. See how you feel afterwards. That's like the best advice ever. And that's something I didn't do for almost all of college. And then finally at the very end of college, I did and learned a ton. But we went to Nashville and we went to Knoxville and we went to Asheville to talk to people who ran successful independent theaters. And it was really cool. Like the people were all super nice and just sat down and talked to us, which was really, really cool. We learned a ton. We learned enough that we decided we didn't want to do it anymore, but it was really cool that they just wanted to sit down with us. So
what did you learn that made you not want to do it anymore about the theater thing?
There were a lot of different things, but the thing that the number one thing that it boiled down to that was one of the things that the lady in Asheville said to us was I think they were a couple who ran this awesome one in Asheville that is a pizza place. Have you been there?
No.
They serve really good pizza. And it's like a independent movie theater / pizza parlor.
Sounds legit.
The thing that we learned, I could go into a ton of detail because we learned a lot. Oh my goodness. If you want to learn a ton, just go like pretend you're starting a business for 6 months and like just, you know, tear your heart out and just go run as hard as you can. You will learn so much. So I don't even know that we really intended to go actually build this movie theater up, but the practice of just like going through and pretending that we were was awesome. So one of the things that they pointed out, one of the things we learned pretty quickly is like, it's not like a movie theater on its own is not economically viable. It's, even the big professional movie theaters, they make all their money on, food basically, because they make like a 95% margin on their food and sodas and whatever else. And that's how they're making all their money. No one makes money on tickets, right?
Right, because there's like a crazy revenue split, like week by week, right?
Yeah, and the it's a classic. Like, I mean, it'd be interesting to look at it from like a Michael Porter's Five Forces like model. But like the suppliers of the movie have a tremendous amount of power, and it's very, very consolidated, and they're basically working together to keep prices on movies very, very high. So like do you not make that much money? You don't make that much revenue on tickets, but you also don't get to keep most of it, because like most of it goes back to the studio.
Yeah, so I've heard it's like the first week is a 100% to the studio, and then second week is like a 90-10 split. Third week is like 80-20 split.
Yeah, and they also get to control. They get to say like, you know, hey, this is a big Tom Cruise movie. You got to keep it in your movie theater for like 13 weeks or something. On four screens, which is like insane, you know. So even by the end, if nobody's seeing it anymore, like you don't get to you don't have any autonomy over your screens. Your the distributors do. So that part of it is not economically viable. So the way I heard the woman in Asheville described it to us was like, listen, every restaurant has its hook. We just happen to have the most expensive hook ever, you know? So like, maybe the hook is you have an amazing chef. Maybe your hook is that you have a really, really cool location. Maybe your hook is just that like you're in a convenient location and you have good reviews on Yelp, whatever it is. Sure. And you know, you've got a cool aquarium, you know, their hook is movies.
Yeah. Their hook is like, we have like 2,500 square feet of space and some very expensive to maintain upholstery. And we pay a ton of licensing fees to major conglomerates.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what it is. So he was like, we can charge a little bit extra for our pizza and beers because we have the most expensive hook ever. And we don't make any money on the hook, you know? He's like, but it's important that you realize is like, if you get into this business, you are a restaurant manager who also has the most expensive and complicated hook ever. And like people are always going to be yelling at you and telling you that you're doing it wrong. So like,
that's hilarious. That was the thing.
So that was like a very, very funny conversation, and it was enlightening. And the thing more than anything else was like the part that he pointed out about, like, he was like, oh, cool. I'm glad you guys want to get into this business. Like, we love cinema so much that we think it's an important line of work. It would be great to see like Chattanooga get something like this. We want to be supportive, blah, blah, blah. And then he was like, whatever one of the guys in Asheville said, do you want to be a restaurant manager? Do you guys love managing restaurants? Do you love like being up till 2 a.m. sweeping the floor? Because like, and I was like, no, I work in a restaurant right now and I kind of hate it. And he's like, okay, cool. So like, if you do this, you're just a restaurant manager. Is that what you want to do? And like, do you want to be like managing people's shifts and then like covering for them when they don't show up because they're like 17 years old and like have other stuff going on that's more important than this place? I was like, oh, is that what this is?
Right.
So again, it's like, it's knowing what a job is actually like and not the theoretical idea of it. I love the theoretical idea of running a movie theater. The economic reality of it is that it is actually being a restaurant manager, and that's where you're making all your money, and that there are a lot of things that go wrong.
And that's one of those, the things that you have described here, two of your examples, one, being a banker, and the other being a independent cinemateur, both of them, you discovered in the end that being a banker is actually being a salesman, and being a cinema owner is actually being a restaurant manager, right? Yeah. And it kind of makes me wonder, like, how many real jobs are there? You know?
Yeah.
Like,
right?
If you think about it, right? So I'm going to say there's a certain type of job which I'm going to call administrator, right? Which is you send emails and you manage calendars and you like facilitate conversations and you sit in meetings and you make decisions. Then there's a type of job that I would call sort of like number cruncher, right?
Yep.
Which is like accountants and sort of data driven managerial positions where like you're tracking metrics and KPIs and stuff. Then there's sales jobs, and then there are a whole litany of like computer production jobs, right? Where your job is to produce things using computers, whether that is video editors or graphic designers or programmers or whatever, right? There's all those types of jobs. And then you've got like C-suite jobs. And then there's like, you know, obviously those are just like the white collar ones, right? There's obviously all sorts of other jobs, like restaurant managers, and most jobs are basically restaurant managers.
It's really true.
Yeah.
Even the lady like running the bounce house at like the trampoline fun house is basically a restaurant manager. She's selling nachos.
Yeah, or like the people who run the pool, right? The pool is basically a snack shop with a very expensive hook.
A very expensive hook where a lot of things can go wrong.
Right. Very expensive, kind of dangerous, maintained by people who are stoned. But yeah, like, that's amazing. I'm so excited to just start walking around the world realizing how many people are actually just restaurant managers.
It's really incredible. It's really incredible.
Salesmen and restaurant managers.
Seriously, though. Is.
Oh, man.
I love that idea that there's only, like, actually five jobs.
Yeah, there's five jobs and a bunch of dog whistles.
Have you had that experience where, like, the theoretical idea of a job has hooked you, and then you go in to realize, like, wow, that is not, like, the theoretical idea of what that is, and then what that actually requires out of you 40 hours a week, and the kind of personality that that requires are two totally different things in my head.
Yes. So this is, and this I believe to be the case with all cool jobs. Every cool job is awesome 15 years into your career. And there's so few, I would say programming is one of the few exceptions where like it can be cool from the get-go. Maybe it's just because I love my job. There are so few jobs that are like actually as cool as you think on day one. Information security is a super cool field, right? And there are some people who are having a lot of fun doing InfoSec, and their jobs on a day-to-day basis are really cool. But those people have been working there for 15 years or went to jail for 4 years before getting promoted to the job that they have now, one or the other. But like information security, like most low-level InfoSec jobs are super boring. You know, like there's a ton of low level InfoSec jobs that are basically just like, say you're auditing AT&T or something, right? So you get like a list of like 7,000 API endpoints from AT&T, right? Ugh. And like you go check API endpoints from AT&T day in and day out. And at the end of the week, you've accumulated a list of like, you know, 15 potential targets, right? And you pass them on to your boss, and your boss pokes at them and ends up hacking three of them and using that to get into the network and do some stuff and like do like a really impressive hack. And then the end of the engagement comes and he needs to go show the CTO at AT&T like all of the cool stuff that they were able to do with just really limited access. And so now your job is to go through and like take this hack that your boss did and like codify it and turn it into a thing and write out recommendations about, you know, and do all this stuff. And basically all you've done is just like, you know, written documents about like, we assessed the situation and here's our recommendations, right? Which is like literally any consulting job ever. There's someone in the company whose job is like write out, we assessed the situation and here are our recommendations, right?
Right, right.
And the, you know, the higher level people who get to do, you know, cool stuff, who like, you know, get to wear FedEx uniforms and sneak in to plug their router into the networking closet, they're having a great time. But there's like two of them, you know, because like you can't just walk in there hella deep with like 20 people in FedEx uniforms being like, where's the networking closet? Because that's just fishy, you know, so you got, that's more of a lone wolf type of a deal.
Yeah, well, it's like the people who think, like, people always, a classic example is like people always assume like the video game industry must be so fun to work in. But it's like,
right.
If you're on the programming side, you are at best doing like debugging for code that somebody else wrote. And if you are on the art side, you're like maybe working on one skin for one like wall that's in the background of one cutscene, you know?
Yeah.
Like the game Destiny, I think, had like over 10,000 people working on it, and two of them were creative directors, right?
Perfect. Perfect plosives.
Even if I pop them right in there, it's okay.
Pop your peas.
I'm quitting all of my stuff.
Gotta turn off my fan.
I just put a little tiny sock over my microphone. It's working pretty well.
Just a regular old sock?
Just a regular sock that's spent a lot of time on my feet, too.
It's saturated. Bezos. That's all I had to say is Bezos. What's his deal? What's wrong with that guy?
Yeah, I don't know. I've given Amazon a lot of money over the years.
Just double down on slightly toxic corporate culture. Yeah, yeah. One thing I think we do need to continue talking about is your Indonesian internet and how bad it is.
What was I saying?
We were talking about knowing what a particular job is actually like and understanding how you fit into that.
And part of it is also just being like the stage where we're at in our careers. Like, I heard friend of ours, Mike, works in Washington, does a lot of interesting stuff with politics, but he described having like, you know, cohort after cohort of like ambitious, idealistic 22-year-olds showing up in Washington, getting ready to like change the world and you know, reshape the culture of our nation's capital. And he's like, you know, his line was always like, why don't you put some paper in the fucking copy machine, you know? Like,
yeah,
why? Like, because that's what's actually required of you right now, because you don't know anything
right yet.
Which is how I feel a lot of the time. Is like, and luckily, like, I feel like I've moved just past that, where I'm actually starting to like do some things that I'm more interested in. And but I've bought that trust and bought that freedom from my bosses by like putting a lot of paper and a lot of copy machines, right?
Right.
Because that's what's required of us. That's what we're supposed to be doing. And it's kind of, it's humbling, and it's, I don't know. I don't want to make it sound like it's like we paid our dues or something, but like that's what you're supposed to be doing in your 20s.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one way of looking at it. I mean, I am more cynical about that, where I would say that like a lot of industries are set up that way on purpose. Hmm. With like some hazing built in, you know, and I think that's largely part of the sort of like weird discriminatory hiring practices stuff we talked about last week.
Yeah.
You know, like those words that that are appealing to white dudes, you know, like ambitious and go-getter and stuff like that. Like a lot of that sort of reeks of that type of culture of like, pay your dues, kiss ass for 5 years, and then you'll make six figures, you know?
I don't know. Maybe we're getting at two slightly separate things, but I feel like college-age idealistic people have big ideas and want to jump straight to the part where they're, like, influencing people and, like, making the world a better place. And my point is just, like, there are appropriately several steps between you and like changing culture and influencing people and making the world a better place. Cause like you need to understand what work is before you can really do that. And like, no one has a reason to listen to you yet.
Yeah. And this is, this I think comes back to a little bit of a disagreement that we've had before. And I think this is the thing that, that maybe led me to become so embroiled in the idea of the Protestant work ethic in that conversation that we had, was the idea of taking what I see as like a system of like cause and effect that is naturally playing out and turning that into what feels like a little bit like a moral issue, right? And so my issue with the present work ethic is basically like, you know, the idea that like the sort of effective use of time and energy is a moral issue, whereas I think of it more as like a reality issue, where it's like, yeah, if you don't use time and energy effectively, like, you won't be happy about it, right? And it kind of goes the same way here, where I think, like, it is the natural way of things that, like, youthful, egotistical, particularly men, want to change the world immediately, right? And I think it's also the natural way of things that they either do that or become humbled, and in the vast majority of cases, they just become humbled, you know?
Right.
Because it's just very unlikely, you know, it's just very unlikely that all those who seek to change the world will be effective, you know? And I think the arrogance and immediate, you know, results driven mentality that a lot of people have when they're young and dumb, leads a lot of people to just give up on changing the world as soon as they realize that it's hard, you know? And so while I do think that, you know, people, sort of the elder statesmen of whatever industry you're in, will at a certain point, like, sit you down and be like, why don't you put some paper in the copy machine?
Mm-hmm.
There is kind of an instinct to, like, to say that that sort of youthful arrogance is morally a bad thing, you know? Where I don't really think that youthful arrogance is, like, a moral problem. I think that youthful arrogance is a very practical problem that solves itself, you know? And, like, it's not even really that much of a problem. It's only a problem when the youthfully arrogant ones get in a position where they can really upset some apple carts, right? And it's usually they don't even know how to get into those positions.
So I'm not making an argument. Like, I'm not really making a moral argument.
I don't think you are. I don't think you are.
I think the main thing I'm saying is, like, I think it would have served me well to be told that when I was youthful and idealistic and, like, critical of things that I didn't understand. I think I see a lot of millennials who are, like, being baristas because they're just waiting for that awesome thing to roll along where they're going to get to really make an impact. And I see intelligent people who are, like, kind of waiting around for that awesome thing. And I'm saying, like, you should probably just go do something for a little while and, like, build up a little credibility and figure out how things actually work before that thing rolls along. And when that thing rolls along, you'll be better equipped, you know?
No, yeah. And I totally think that's true. I agree with you that, like, if I knew and understood that earlier in life, it would have been great. I'm of the opinion that, like, the level of, like, youthful arrogance that I had at that point in my life would not have allowed me to hear that, even if someone was telling me to it.
I wouldn't have heard it. Yeah.
Right. And so, like,
I'd be like, yeah, that's all good and well for the dumb people around me. Not me, though.
Yeah. Or it would just be like, it would be like, oh, yeah, yeah, you're another robot in the machine, and you will go the way of the dinosaur when my new world order takes effect, you know? like, and when you're young and dumb and arrogant, and this is, like, a characteristically white male attribute here, right? But, like, when you're young and dumb and arrogant and pretty sure that the world is your oyster, and, like, whatever you set your mind to is going to take effect in really some really interesting ways for everyone else. you sit there, and that is where, like, all of these, like, white dudes who have haters come from, right? Like, there's all of these just, like, visionary bro culture that we've talked about, right? Where, like, whenever anybody, like, starts to get successful or, like, have an idea that they've thought through more than, like, 5 minutes, they're suddenly worried about, like, people stealing their idea and, like, the haters coming out of the woodwork, right?
Yeah, right.
And, like, it's just so unlikely because, like, it's just so unlikely that you'll be effective at all, right? At that stage in life. That's the thing.
But like really great, really great ideas are so few and far between. And the, like, I still think like even late into college, I still had this idea of like, if we sit around in this living room eating Mongolian beef and drinking Bud Light and like tossing the football back and forth, one of us is going to have an epiphany. And once we have that epiphany, like the road is paved to success. And it's right. Like now, especially being in an emerging market. So like being in Indonesia, again, we're kind of beating a dead horse here, but in Indonesia, we like everyone here is looking and saying like, oh, we're at the early stages of being a developed market, and we can look at other developed markets and see the things that they have. They have delivery grocery, and they have Amazon, and they have Uber, and they have this and that. And it's like, okay, so it's like pretty abundantly obvious that we're going to have all of those things. So like the ideas are effectively free, right? Like here's a market where
right.
These things have not been built yet, but we all know the ideas that are going to work. It's like almost bulletproof ideas. And so like what the thing that you see is like, it's 100% about execution. I think in like maybe in Silicon Valley, it's like 5% about ideas and 95% about execution. But like here, it's 100% about execution, because the thing is like building a company, hiring the right people, developing the right culture where people aren't leaving left and right, like managing your money, learning how to fundraise, like all of that stuff is what's actually hard. And ideas, who cares about ideas? Like it's about execution and having a team and managing yourself and getting things done, right? The part one of my thought on my topic was like understanding what a job actually requires. And the part two of where we get into like the, I guess part two for me is understanding yourself and how you fit into it.
Mm-hmm.
And we could probably talk for hours on this, but I'll try to keep it somewhat confined. Is just understanding like, what are you actually capable of? And what are the things that like delight you? And what are the things that actually drain you? And you do have some idea of that in college, but I feel like you learn a lot more once you actually get on the job. And this is where like we get into really valuable conversations, like the one I told you about where my boss, you know, just in the middle of a random day said, here are three things you're good at and here are three things you're terrible at.
Right. Actually, I was thinking about that later. You should tell me what those three things were, but carry on with your story.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, because it ties in also with the spreadsheets thing. Maybe we'll talk about it over there. But my feeling is obviously it's just important to know yourself because it's important to know yourself. But also in this particular conversation, it's like I've spent time, I think, like pretending that I'm good at things. And to me now, in retrospect, I'm looking at that like it's almost like pretending to be somebody you're not on a date. Which is like a silly, it's like a silly thing to do. Like if you are really infatuated with somebody and you know that they like particular characteristics or they like particular things and you sort of feign interest in those things or pretend to be like that person that they might be interested in, like that can only last so long, right? Like that's not actually going anywhere. Right. And so like, there's no point in exhausting yourself trying to do those things that like don't delight you and don't naturally fit with who you are. So I'm thinking about this more and more because like when you get down to like, okay, what does it actually require to be a cinemateur is to be a restaurant manager. Okay. What are you actually capable of doing and what exhausts you and what delights you? Well, like none of those things. Right. So, trying to put those two trying to put those two puzzle pieces together is where things get really interesting. And like I think until you start working, it's very difficult to define the edges of those puzzle pieces, and of course they change over time too, but like once you start to like get to where we are, which is like a few years in, you start to have a much clearer idea of what the edges of those puzzle pieces actually look like, and then you start to think about like how things might fit together. And I think that's interesting.
And like to carry like what I think is starting to become an ongoing theme of like connecting sort of work to the larger picture of like being a human and mindfulness. I think that's true in a lot of other areas besides work as well. You know, like I think that, you know, as you just gain more experience in the world, the things that you thought were ridiculously simple as a younger man, a younger, more arrogant man or woman, if that's who's listening to the show, but I'm just talking from personal experience. But as a younger, more arrogant man, a lot of things seemed ridiculously simple, including ethics and politics and my own emotional nature.
Yeah.
Right. And like relationships with other human beings and starting billion-dollar companies and, you know, all these things just seemed so simple. And like the world was my oyster and I was just going to do them all, you know. And, you know, you get older and like you realize that there are edges to the puzzle pieces. Right. And that like if everything was just that easy, then everyone would have the perfect life, you know. And so then you get to start to be in what I now start to think is a pretty enviable position of having a little bit of perspective and starting to make priority decisions, you know? And so you get to start making those sort of priority decisions where, like, you get to choose, like, you know, what do I want to focus on? Do I want to focus on starting a $1 billion company? Or do I want to focus on learning some basic skills that maybe later down the road I can use to start a $100,000 company, you know?
Yeah.
Do I want to like have a bunch of relationships or do I want to just like have this one relationship? And do I want to like invest in this one? Right. And that's like a scary decision to make early on in life. And like, and that's like, I think like that sort of prioritization, like, you know, there's definitely like you become aware of like your strengths and weaknesses in all of these areas and you figure out which battles are worth fighting when you start to develop just a little bit of perspective. And like, and I know that like 5 years down the road, I'm going to think that I had very little perspective sitting where I am now, you know?
Yeah.
But like when you start to develop just enough perspective to see that you can't do it all at once, you know, and that you do have to sort of prioritize things. Like, I think that life in general ends up being mostly about, like, deciding which card to put in which column, you know, in sort of every area of life, you know, emotional and interpersonal and professional and spiritual.
Well, the last part about this is, like, and this is where it gets into the judo stuff, is, like, how do you get into a place where you're better at like rolling with the punches on that instead of like raging against it? Because so as like an example, I would like to start a business someday, I think, maybe not. But when I hear about like when I listen to like I listen to the first episode of the new startup season and it's about the guy from American Apparel who's articles you read about him sounds like a really not great guy, but this show's going to try to make him a little more three-dimensional, which is interesting. But, you know, he's got this, like, he's got that classic, like, never-ending energy. He's always in sales mode. He's just, like, running around to suppliers. He's like, I'm just driving. I don't even know where I'm going yet. Oh, I'm going to go to this place. I'm going to, like, talk to this person and sell, and, like, get people, like, drum up excitement about this thing, like, you know, sleep 4 hours a night, whatever. And, like, I look at myself and I'm like, you know, I don't think I really have that gene so much. Like I have certain skills that could be really valuable for a company, but like, I don't think I have that like indomitable spirit and like unlimited energy and like things like that. Maybe I do deep down somewhere that I don't know about yet, but like right now I don't think I have that so much. So my options are like, I can rage against that and say like, this card is stuck in this column. And I hate that. And I'm frustrated about that. And I'm going to dwell on it. Or I can get to a healthier place, which is to say like, it is what it is. I am wired the way I'm wired. And I need to just go find the thing that's best suited for the thing that I can do. And maybe that just means like being a partner to somebody, or maybe it means like being the third or fourth hire at a startup where I can like really provide value to somebody who does have that indomitable spirit. You know, I'm not really sure where I'm going with that, but I think that's where it starts getting into judo, right? Is like knowing what you can do, knowing what you can't do, and like rolling with the punches too, as people always say, like use your opponent's strength against them, or like use your reality's strength against itself to like use the way things are going instead of like fighting the tide, rolling with it and figuring out what that means for you and to be satisfied with it. Did that make any sense? That was a long ramble. I'm not sure that that was coherent at all.
Yeah, no, I'm really into that. So I keep coming back to like the idea that I think that's something that comes naturally, you know, and I've said that like a lot of places now. And I think what I mean when I say that is like, I think that if you are a person who examines yourself, that is something that will come naturally, right? And that like if you take the sort of upfront initiative of sort of being mindful, right, and like examining and checking in with yourself on a regular basis, that like that rolling with the punches, hopefully you never end up in a situation where you were absolutely positive that you were one way and you find out overnight that you're another way. Right. Mm-hmm. And like that I think is the big key of mindfulness for me, is like knowing what way I am, so that when the day comes where I need to know whether I'm this way or that way, I know. And so like when, as that relates to like what you're talking about now with like finding a job and figuring out like what type of company you'll fit well into and whether you should start a business or just augment someone else's business or something like that. Like, I think what you're doing now, which is sort of the smaller tasks, like what you were talking about before of building dashboards that measure metrics, right? You build some dashboards and they measure some metrics, right? It's almost like you're, you know, painting the fence or wax on, wax off, right?
Right.
It's like those small motions that teach you about yourself and, you know, the way that you work and the way that you work well and the way that you don't work well. And each of these sort of small jobs and tasks that you work on now is teaching you something about who you are and how you work, that down the road, when the thing is put in front of you, hopefully you'll have more information that'll allow you to make a better decision. And obviously you'll never have all the information that lets you know that you're making the right decision. That's very rare. You know, it's very rare to know that you're making the right decision. But the more information you have about yourself through mindfulness, the more confidence you can have in your own decisions, given the sort of underlying tenet that, like, at the end of the day, I'll be okay. You know? Even if the decision is wrong, I will learn more about myself and be okay, you know? And so, like, to me, that's the big thing with rolling with the punches, is that, like, you have to assume underlying all of that, that, like, that life is, you know, at its base level, that, like, life and your endeavor to, like, go through life and do the accomplishment of having lived a life, like, that at the end of the day, you will have done okay. You know, you won't have lived the greatest life ever or the worst life ever, but you will have lived a life, right? And, like, mm-hmm. That's something that I, like, come back to a lot. And, like, that is something that shows up in, like, all sorts of places. Like, I am not the best programmer in the world, but I'm also not the worst programmer in the world. I'm a pretty good programmer, you know? I have a lot to learn from other people. I'm not the best programmer where I work. I'm not the worst programmer where... Well, I don't know. I might be the worst programmer where I work. I haven't seen everyone's code. I know I'm not the best. But like I'm an adequate programmer, I'm an adequate employee, I'm an adequate boyfriend, I'm an adequate tenant to my landlord, you know, I'm adequate. And I don't mean adequate in like sort of the demeaning way in which we call people average in America, right?
Right.
I mean adequate in the sense of like I'm right sized about this to the best of my ability, right? I'm not too big, I'm not too small, I'm Goldilocks in this.
Yeah. No, I feel that.
So I think like the more that you can stay in that spot, the more that those decisions become less scary and you become more prepared for them.
I don't really understand how things work.
Where at the mall do they sell routers?
I got a router at the mall.
I need so many more details than you're giving me.
So I was like, that's why I am constantly convincing the internet that I'm not a robot, and why I also cannot play PlayStation anymore.
We've talked about the internet for quite some time here.
Oh, I do. I was talking.
I hope you put like the last 30 seconds over music. I am looking forward to hearing you justify this picture of Vladimir Putin doing judo and stretching.
Oh, yeah.
Is that just Marxist doing calisthenics?
Oh, no, but that would be such a good use of that picture. No, it's because I referenced judo, and I like the idea of whenever I have you know what? It actually might be, I'll probably cut all this out, but I think it's worth talking about the process that we've implemented.
No, we can definitely talk about it. No, I think we should talk about it for the podcast.
Yeah. So originally I was just, I would have all of my meandering thoughts about different things that we could talk about on the podcast, and I would write them all out in a Google Sheet, which is how I manage my entire life, is on Google Sheets and Google Docs.
And
so
correct.
I was put them onto a Google document where you can use the outline, which I think is really helpful. And it was growing and growing and growing until the point I had like 30 topics on there, most of which were kind of dumb, but then the best ones would kind of percolate to the top and we'd talk about those. You pointed out that a free Trello board would accomplish the same thing. So now we are using Trello.
I don't necessarily think it accomplishes the same thing. I think it accomplishes much more.
It accomplishes what I was hoping to do, but in a better way.
Yeah, it's kind of based on like the whole agile methodology of like moving, like turning things into tasks and moving them through a process where like an item is always like in a certain state, right? And so like each column is a state, and we move, basically we come up with like podcast topics and we put them on Trello cards, and then they move through these various columns.
Yeah. And I like this a lot. It took me a minute to get used to it, and now that I'm used to it, I really like it. And I like their iOS app too. So anytime I have thoughts, it's good to be able to jump in here and either start a new card, or what is happening more and more frequently is I have a little fleeting thought and I go to write down and I realize it actually relates to one of our existing cards. So I can go in there and just kind of edit the description on one of our existing cards, and then it gets more interesting.
Yeah.
So the nice thing is for us now, we can do, if we want to do a little follow-up, we can just pull right from this follow-up list. Is that what it is? Is it a list? Is it a bucket?
I think it's a list. I wouldn't call it a bucket now.
And then for some reason I got when I thought a topic got to the point where it was ready to discuss, I wanted to put a picture on it so that it would look better. So the topic that I feel ready for either one of the ones I did, but the one that I put on there, I had referenced judo, and so I looked up a picture of judo, and for some reason the majority of the pictures that came up for me, I think this might have something to do with Indonesia, I'm not sure, but were of Vladimir Putin doing judo, which I thought was very, very funny.
He's very accomplished, that man.
Yeah, he's something else, isn't he? You ever see that picture of him with his shirt popped off riding a horse?
Yeah, yeah. You can almost see why Trump admires him so much.
Yeah, the world is moving towards strong men. It's very disconcerting because I am not a strong man.
No.
I am not for this world.
I was told about 5 years ago by your cousin Drew that I was bird chested, and that has stuck with me ever since. And I think that is very much the definition of my physique. And as the strong men take over, the bird chested men will be relegated to positions of productivity and advisory roles.
I don't even know what that means. Never heard that before. Had you heard that before?
I had not, but it makes a lot of sense. Look at a bird, look at the chest.
Yeah.